Hello, welcome everybody to episode 115 of the No Normal Show for Thursday, August 5th, 2021, brought to you by Revive Health. This is our weekly deep dive into how hospital and health system marketers can navigate what we call the No Normal. I'm Chris Bevelo, Chief Brand Officer here at Revive Health and your host for the show, joined as always by Chase Kleckner, Senior Marketing Manager at Revive Health and our show's producer. Hello, Chase.
Hi, Chris. Good to see you as always. Excited for today's conversation.
I am as well. I'm also excited because Stephanie is with us again. Stephanie Weirwell, who's been a guest on the show before. Stephanie is our Senior Vice President and Content Lead at Revive Health. She helps brands determine what stories to tell and where to tell them across digital, traditional, and emerging channels. With experience both in and out of healthcare, Stephanie creates strategies for consumer-first healthcare content, social and digital marketing. Her expertise includes social and digital strategy, website redesign, influencer marketing, reputation management, and customer service for global national brands like MD Anderson, American Cancer Society, Amazon, Delta Airlines, Walmart, and Wells Fargo. Hey, Stephanie.
Hello. Happy to be here again.
Yes, this is going to be a super fun show. I cannot wait to get started. Let's get through all the housekeeping stuff, and then we will dive in. So if you're new to the show, on this podcast, we share industry trends, research, stories from inside of healthcare, from outside of healthcare, whatever we think is helpful to help you navigate that no normal. If you want to know more about what we mean by the no normal, check out a blog post we wrote just over a year ago. Chase will share a link to that in the comment section if you're with us live. That might have been the quickest housekeeping run through ever, because I can't wait to dive into this, because we have been talking about some weighty topics of late. Unfortunately, the world is weighty, more weighty than most of us would want, with COVID and vaccines and whatnot. So we're going to take a little detour from that today. Though what we're going to talk about 100% applies to some of the things that you all are challenged with. We are going to talk about behavioral design and behavioral economics and behavioral marketing. It's a huge passion for Stephanie, a huge passion for myself. We should put a warning label on this show. We are not behavioral scientists. We do not have degrees in behavioral science. That's just really important to know. It's really passion for both of us. And we've studied it a lot. We've explored it a lot. We've used it with some clients. So we don't have to be dangerous, which is what's going to make this show pretty awesome. So let's dive in. We want to kind of talk about our influences, what's influenced us in this field. We're going to kind of go back and forth on that, sharing some resources that both of us love. But we probably should start with what the heck are we talking about with behavioral design, behavioral marketing, behavioral economics. If you're not familiar with that, let's just do a super quick tutorial. So I'll start, Stephanie, and you can add context. I think the best way to kind of explain this is, you know, most of us are familiar with economics as a discipline. Classic economics, there's kind of two parts to it, right? Most of us think about, you know, the painful course we might have taken in college about supply and demand. That's macroeconomics. But macroeconomics is driven by microeconomics, which is basically how do humans behave. And classic economics holds that humans behave in a rational way. We are rational beings that will always do what is in our best interest. And the field of behavioral economics, which started decades ago and has become more and more prominent over time, holds that that's a bunch of BS, that we are not, in fact, rational beings. We act against our best interests, probably on an hourly basis, if not a daily basis, all the time in significant ways. And so if you really want to understand consumer behavior, if you really want to understand what motivates consumers, you got to understand it at a behavioral level. And that's really the essence of this. Behavioral design is that thinking applied to design in all ways. Behavioral marketing is that thinking applied to marketing in all ways. But obviously it applies to what all of us do, which is design and marketing and branding. If we want to maximize our efforts in those disciplines, we really have to understand what motivates our audiences. And if we're really going to do that, we got to understand this science. All right. What did I miss, Stephanie?
Yeah, I'll just give a little bit of setup around how this came about, this field. So one of my favorite folks to watch and read and listen to is Daniel Kahneman, who is a psychologist and economist, and won the Nobel Prize for his work in behavioral economics several decades ago. And he worked with a man named Amos Tversky, and they did a lot of work just digging into exactly what Chris is talking about, and looking into what are the motivators that drive decision making, what are the motivators that drive people's daily lives. And so I'll just hold up one awesome work by him if you're interested, is Thinking Fast and Slow. And this shows a lot of the work that Kahneman and Tversky have done for decades and decades in this field. He won the Nobel Prize, or they won the Nobel Prize, for their work on prospect theory, which you might have heard of in school at some point. And that's the idea that people have a lot more emotion or pain over things that they lose versus things that they gain. So the idea, which ties back to economics, which is, you know, the emotions that someone feels over losing $2,000 or losing $1,000 is about equal to the emotion of gaining $2,000, right? So it's like that big of a difference. So I think there's a lot of interesting implications, even in that theory right there in healthcare, about how we message and think about what motivates someone to make a decision. And I'll just note one more kind of foundational piece of this work, but their work in general, is around system one and system two thinking, which highlights the fact that system one thinking is automatic decisions. It's most of what we do every single day. It's very automatic, right? We make snap judgments based on gut intuition. But system two is slower thinking. That is where we're actually stopping, solving a problem, putting a lot of work into it. And so understanding how people make system one decisions, understanding how those automatic decisions are made, is really, really important in marketing, because that's the bulk of what makes someone choose one brand over another, or maybe even sometimes make a decision about a doctor. So that is just kind of a foundational piece of this field.
Awesome. All right, so let's go a little deeper. I know we're gonna talk a lot about biases, and you're gonna cover this more. First of all, here's a book. I don't know, is it backwards? It's not backwards. Sweet. Judgment in Managerial Decision-Making, which sounds horrifying. It's a textbook, but the thing is basically chock full of biases. It's so interesting to read about biases and what drives us in terms of mental models and things that we have built in. So that's where I would start too, as a foundational thing. We should also say that if you're new to this, most people have heard of Predictably Irrational. Got to read that. It gets into behavioral sciences super deep in really fun ways. But what I'm going to start with is, it's a digital book, so I have to hold it up like this, biology. If you have read my books, if you've heard me speak, you've probably heard me talk about this. This is where the book is really about how the use of technology like fMRIs allows us to dig into the science of behavioral economics and how it actually shows itself in human behavior. So it's fascinating. And there's two stories in it that always come to mind when I think about this. The first is, again, think about rational versus emotional and rational versus irrational. It tells the story of efforts by many places, including the federal government, to try to combat smoking. And we're all familiar with, you know, whether you smoke or not, most people are familiar with the warning labels on cigarettes. And so those have been there. That was, you know, mandated by the federal government back, I think, in the 60s or 70s. And at some point they said, look, these aren't having the effect we want. We've got to make them more severe. So the language became really kind of disturbing and like, you will die, but you know, this could, you know, kill your baby kind of stuff if you're pregnant. They started experimenting with photos on cigarette packages of like diseased lungs, because rationally you would think somebody saw that the harsher, more disturbing the message, the more likely they'd be like, oh, this is bad for me, so I should not do this. What fMRI studies showed was it actually has the opposite impact. Because what happens is you're basically telling somebody who knows that what they're doing is not great. Most people who smoke know it's not great for them. They're addicted. They'd love to stop in many cases. There's very few people you have to convince this is not good for you. So when they see those harsher messages, basically you're just reminding them that they've gone down a really crappy path. And their actual emotional reaction in many cases is like, well, I'm screwed anyway, so give me two packs. That was the impact it had. So I think that's a classic example of understanding real motivation, real behavior, not a rational level, but at a different level. Another one that I've used time and time again is the Coke versus Pepsi debate. So many people remember Pepsi running for years and years and years the Pepsi Challenge, which is basically a taste test. And every year they ran it, they won. Pepsi always wins a blind taste test still today. Except for every year, Coke was the dominant brand, sold way more than Pepsi, still the case today. So in the book Biology, they talk about, again, using fMRI technology to try to uncover what's going on. So they ran the Pepsi Challenge and they put people in these machines, and in blind taste tests, again, Pepsi wins. And what they saw was the part of the brain, which I wrote down, which is called the ventral putamen, would flare up. So you can see that in the scans, right? And that's where taste is stimulated, right? So then they changed the experiment and they told people, here's some Coke and here's some Pepsi, right? Same taste test, but now they know. In those trials, 75% of the people said they like Coke. And what happened was you still saw that part of the brain kind of fire up with taste, but you also saw what is called the medial prefrontal cortex, which is responsible for higher thinking and other aspects of brain activity. That also flared up. And what they discovered in other experiences, when that flares up, it overrides everything else. So the emotional context people had for Coke, which is really branding, going back to what Stephanie said, overrode the reality, the rational experience of this actually tastes better. Their brain said, no, that doesn't taste better. This tastes better, despite what their taste bud said. So that shows you the power of understanding this stuff in some of the ways to dig into it.
Yeah, that's such a fascinating story, because I think it applies directly to, you know, us as marketers. We're sitting around deliberating often what's going to make the biggest impact. Is it the features and benefits that we're touting? Is it the brand? Is it the media channels? And many times we don't know, and we can test and learn our way into it. And we could do neuromarketing like you're talking about, right? Like put people into scanners if we had budget for that, or if our clients
had budget for that. Wait, I have to tell you that there's a company out there called Kernel.
Okay.
That has taken this technology down to the size of a helmet. Uh-huh. And the cost is $50,000. And they're starting to send it out to academic medical centers, researchers, and they hope to send it to thousands of people to wear every day so that they can track this on a daily basis. Sorry, I just like that's had to throw it in there. It's coming. Yes. It's coming.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. And I think the power of this is like at a baseline, understanding what have these studies shown over time? What can we learn from this field? And then on top of it, now let's actually do our own studies like you're talking about. And then let's include testing and learning in the market and getting, you know, real, true behavior from people. And I just think it's so much further than, you know, where marketing has been decades before, which is just our own gut instinct.
Right. So talk about the next book, which I joke, we both have it. It takes two hands to lift.
Yes, it does. It's a very, very large textbook-like object. So this is a very, very recent book by Daniel Kahneman, who I was talking about earlier, which shows his work over the last decade or so. It's called Noise, and it's all about kind of the next evolution of behavioral design, which is how people make decisions, and the fact that if you compare decision-making over time among one person or a group of people, there's a lot of differences, variability or noise. And so looking at your own decisions, like if I looked at my decisions and plotted them over time on the same kind of thing, I would actually have a lot of variability depending on what day it is, depending on how I feel, depending on what time of day, all of those kinds of things. If you looked at this group of just us three people, right, and our decisions on a certain topic, we would have a lot of variability. So I'll give an example, and I'll do a little poll. Maybe Chris, you can throw in your guess here. Okay. So if you think about an insurance company, specifically underwriters and claims adjusters, which theoretically do a lot of work based on numbers. You would think it's fairly objective. And so what level of variability do you think that underwriters and claims adjusters have as a group of an insurance company? Pretend you're the CEO and you're making an assessment of the level of variability in those decisions. On a percentage scale, what percentage do you think that would be for a good company?
So you're saying, like, so if there's a car accident and that case gets put in front of me and I'm trying to evaluate how much, you know, the damage is or what the amount of liability is or something like that, how might that decision vary based on the person sitting next to me, the person next to them, right? Exactly. So, I mean, to your point, they should be working within like really strict algorithms and frameworks and guidelines. So theoretically, it shouldn't vary much at all. I would assume if I were the CEO, I would not want to see more than like a 5% variance. But I'm guessing it's probably higher than that. I'm guessing it's probably 25% in reality.
Yeah. So the in this study, CEOs of insurance companies thought it would be about 10%. We've got a guest down here, 45. That's actually really, really good. So yeah. CEOs thought it was about 10%. Hopeful guesses. In fact, for underwriters, it was 55%. And for claims adjusters, it was 43%. So that tells you that even in really objective industries and work, there's a lot of variability. And now then think about more creative industries or more art-led industries. There's a ton of noise. Even in things like judges, that was another kind of industry study here. Judges have a wide amount of variability, which is really scary. So what this work talks about is how do we fix that, right? What do we do about it? How can we understand what causes noise? And I think one thing that's really interesting for healthcare is among physicians, there was a study that noted that physicians actually prescribe more opioids later in the day because just the, you know, kind of they stop using system two thinking and start using system one. Yeah. Let's just throw an easy solution at this problem.
They're tired, right? They're probably tired. They're wore down. Their defenses are down. And they're all the arguments you would have against it, they're, you know, probably just broken. By 5 o'clock, they're like, whatever. Just here, go. I hope not, but sounds like it.
Yes, exactly. And there's some crazy things like if the local football team wins, people make different decisions than when it doesn't. If it's hot outside, people make different decisions than otherwise. So you think about the decisions that consumers are making and how do we understand the level of variability there and how are they going to decide to choose, you know, your physician or hospital for certain surgeries and how can you understand all the things factoring into that? So I think just really fascinating stuff. And I'll just give one more quick example of, I think, something really applicable for all of us in our day-to-days, and that's hiring. So I think we all intuitively know how much variability there is in decision-making processes and hiring. But one of the recommendations is to actually put some structure to interview processes, to filters, to guidelines, to get everybody on the same page, essentially, so that we're not just making our own gut decisions about I like this person and you like that person, but how can we start to create some sense of structure in terms of interview questions, in terms of filters for what we're looking for. And that simple thing, which is maybe feels like common sense, but is very rarely done, can get everybody a little bit more on the same page and reduce the noise in the decision-making process.
What I love about Noise is the book is that it introduces a whole new dimension to consider from in terms of marketing or branding. So, for example, if you're trying to promote more hip replacements, right now there's kind of three different dimensions you need to consider. One is what is the thing you're selling? What is the, you know, where do people go for it? You know, the access to it, what's the price point, all of those things. The second dimension is the people that would most need that. So let's say someone like me, age 53, active, whatever. So you got to understand who the people are. And then the third thing that you typically think about is where those people are at in some kind of journey or phase of their life. So even though I may be 53 and that dude may be 53, I may be closer to a hip surgery than that person. And so you have to take that into context. What this adds to that, which on one hand just is fascinating, on the other hand makes your head want to explode, is all of that is static. All those three things we just talked about are static. Then you've got to throw in this the situational context, like, is it 3 o'clock in the afternoon or 8 a.m.? Is it raining outside or is it sunny? Is the person like, did I just come out of a bad meeting? And so therefore I'm less likely to listen to my doctor. Like, how you have to accommodate for all of that. The book argues that dimension may have more to do with behavior and decision-making than any of the other three. And I feel like that is a fairly new way of thinking. Maybe that's not fair. Maybe that shows my, you know, where I'm at in life, but boy, from a marketing standpoint, trying to figure those things out is, again, exciting and overwhelming.
It is. I geek out about it because it's such a deep rabbit hole of all the different biases to consider, all the different factors to consider. And one more interesting thing is noise actually gets into how machine learning and algorithms can help us with some of this stuff, right? Because we as humans, often we as marketers as well, looking at the situation, can't factor in everything. So how can we start to use algorithms to help us uncover the things that we're not expecting, sort of the unsupervised learning to help us identify the patterns that we wouldn't otherwise see. And I think just predicting, you know, in the next couple of decades, it's going to be really fascinating to marry what data science can do alongside what we've learned through this field and through psychology.
Yeah, for sure. All right, let's talk about some practical things that people can think about and then maybe some actual examples, Stephanie. So the next book on your shelf, Selling Blue Elephants, is written by a guy named Dr. Howard Moskowitz. He's a PhD. This is amazing. A PhD in experimental psychology, which sounds like if I won the lottery, what I would want to go try to get. I mean, it's just incredible. He's created this concept, which he labels as, I'm going to get this right, rule developing experimentation. And he's actually come to brand it mind genomics, which I think is really cool because it's the principle is very similar to what folks do to try to get the perfect tomato in terms of genetics, right? They crossbreed tomatoes until you get the perfect combination of genes that shows you that ripe, juicy red tomato. That is the science of how you get from 1,000 kind of tomatoes to that perfect tomato. So he takes that same concept and applies it to our world primarily. So marketing, packaging, ideas, messaging. And what he's talking about here is think about creative testing. So like ad testing. The problem with a lot of what we do today in terms of trying to understand human behavior is we ask humans. We ask them, what do you think? And what research has shown is what people say very rarely correlates to what they will actually do or how they will behave. So that's it. We're already on dangerous ground there. But if you asked, you know, if you asked a focus group, what do you think of this stapler? What do you think of the color red? Does that make you want to buy the stapler more or less? They'll give you an answer, but it's not an answer you can necessarily trust. What rules develop experimentation does is it says, Chase, do you like the stapler or not? Yes or no? And you answer. And then I show you another one and it's blue. And you answer. And then I show you another one and it's square and you answer. And I do this 100 times. I pre-select variables that I care about. So if it's an ad, I might vary the headline. I might, in the next one, I might vary the photo. I might vary the design. I will vary all of those in different ways. And so what you're getting is somebody's gut reaction to what they're seeing. Yes, I like this one. I couldn't tell you if it's because it's red or not, but I like it. If you do that enough times, what starts to emerge is, hey, no matter how we come at this, red continually shows up in the answers people give that they like, right? We didn't ask them where they like red, but the science of it, right? That the red tomato is where we're ending up with all of the genetic changes that we're making. That is a way to get around asking people at a conscious surface, you know, rational level and digging down into what actually motivates them. So it's a really fascinating concept. We're just starting to think about it at Revive. Like, how do you apply that to creative testing or other things? But a great read on something that applies to all this. So one more, Stephanie, I want to move you along because we've got so much to talk about. Talk about nudge.
I will. Quickly, we had a question to repeat the terminology. Oh. I don't know if that was around mind genomics that you were talking about, or I'm not exactly sure.
I will. So the official name for this process, for how you go about it, is termed RDE, or rule developing experimentation. So you're creating rules, you're picking variables, and you're just testing those variables enough that you've got a mix of all the different variables. So if you've got six variables, I don't know, I'm not going to do the math, I'll get it wrong, but it takes a lot of this to get to the data that you need. But what he's branded it is mind genomics. So you could look up rule developing experimentation, you could look up mind genomics, or you could look up the book Selling Blue Elephants.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Last kind of piece here. So this is Nudge. And it's a book that encapsulates a good amount of work on this idea of nudging. And what a nudge is essentially something that is a cheap and efficient way to get people to make the decision that you want them to make. Ideally, a healthy decision or something that's better for them. Now, a nudge cannot be something that's mandated. So it can't be, for example, a tax on junk food or a ban on junk food. It has to be something that is cheap and efficient. For example, moving healthier foods to eye level of the shelf. That would be an example of a nudge. So I'll give an example that I think is especially applicable for what we do. And that's in the realm of organ donations. So there was studies done comparing how the U.S. handles organ donations versus other countries. And the U.S., for organ donations, it is an opt-in, of course. You have to decide that you want to be an organ donor. You have to check the box. You have to do a little bit of paperwork. In other countries like Australia, it is an opt-out. So you are automatically assumed to be an organ donor unless you change your mind or decide and tell them no and opt out of it and do the paperwork there, check the box there. So that plays back into one of the biases called the default option, which essentially means that if something is set as the default, you're much more likely to just roll with it and not opt out. We see this every day, thinking about if a box is checked when you're signing up for an email program that you want all these newsletters, you usually just accept it and go forward instead of stopping and opting out. So in comparing those two, there were much more organ donors in the countries where it is an opt-out versus in the US where it's an opt-in. So this is really interesting because it gets us thinking about all the decision points that have to do with what we do on a daily basis in healthcare, right? Thinking about how someone schedules an appointment and the number of things they have to do to make that possible. Maybe they need to see their primary care physician. Maybe they have to then call and schedule another appointment with their orthopedist. They've got to find an orthopedist. They've got to jump through all these hoops. And how could we simplify it? This is the kind of work that UX does every day with simplification. How do we simplify a process, which essentially then nudges someone in to make the decision that you want them to make?
Yeah, and we have played with this with some of our hospital and health system clients. So as Stephanie alluded to, a great example is think of like an online HRA. So maybe you have a joint pain HRA. So, hey, I've got some joint pain. I'm going to come to your website. You've got me to your website. Congratulations. I'm going to take this assessment, right? And if the assessment shows that, hey, you ought to talk to an orthopedist. What you've told us tells us that you need to go see a specialist. Usually what happens is, best case scenario, you give them a choice to go find one of your specialists. A lot of times that doesn't even happen. It's just like, hey, you should go see a specialist. Thanks for coming. So we got to solve that part first. But just sending somebody to your find a doc, here's your orthopedist, right? So some systems have 100, 200 orthopedists. So, okay, now some of these biases that we're talking about come into play. So choice overload, which means if somebody's faced with too many choices, they will not make a choice. This has been proven time and time again. We think it's better to offer 18 kinds of toothpaste. Actually, that makes it harder for people to choose your toothpaste, right? They'll put off the choice. We all have decision fatigue. Anybody listening to this podcast probably by about 6 o'clock. It goes back to the point about opioids. Decision fatigue probably is part of why doctors are like, okay, I have a decision here. Am I going to fight this or not? Oh, I'm so tired of fighting every single person who's asking for OxyContin. So my defenses are down, whether they realize that or not. So what if instead of sending somebody to your find a doc for a list of all the orthopedists and making them figure it out. What if at the end of that HRA experience, you say, hey, you need an orthopedist. So we've gone ahead and created an appointment for you at 4 o'clock, 3 weeks from now with Dr. Weirwell. Now you can cancel it right here. Here's a button. You can cancel it. You can change the time or date, or you can change the doctor, but you don't have to do anything. You're set. How many more people would end up in front of that doctor than if it is the way it is now, which is they have to figure out how to make all that work, right? Of course, people are going to opt out of it. But again, default bias tells us you're going to get far more people to stick with it because it's the default. And so it's just such an important concept for people to understand and start to use. I have one more story. I don't know if you want to add something else before I get into the last. Oh, we should give a shout out, by the way. One of the people that we wanted to talk to about this for a project we work on is Dr. Mitesh Patel, who had, when we found out about him, had the title of Director of the Penn Medicine Nudge Unit, which is phenomenal. Now he's moved on to become VP for Clinical Transformation and National Lead for Behavioral Insights for Ascension. So bigger system, probably more impact. The fact that we've got health systems that are actually having that level of person dedicated to this shows you the power of it. All right, you want me to share the last example of this, which was, I just think it's, again, so powerful. It's out of our space, but it's a good one to end with. Many of you may have seen this. It was a story in the New York Times on Sunday, and it's about a company called WinRed that was basically established as a GOP fundraising arm, a company. So not part of the official presidential campaign for Donald Trump in 2020, but aligned with it with the sole purpose of raising money. And what they did was they took the idea of nudge and default bias to a pretty extreme place. So they were, you know, they would send fundraising emails, and that's very common. And they would say, hey, give whatever, give what you can. And what they started experiment with was having a default box that said, whatever I give, I want to give every week or every month on a continual basis. Now, you would think that that would be something that people should choose. They use the power of nudge to check it. So a lot of people didn't know that that's what they were signing up for. And then what they discovered was, hey, the more that it's harder for people to see this, the more people don't check it. So they started to bury the checked question in a lot of other text, making it hard to pull out. They went further. They ended up adding 2 checkboxes, one of which they actually called a money bomb. Because it went off in terms of way more money. Because you might see the first one and go, no, I'm giving $500 now, not every month for eternity. So uncheck it. But if you didn't see the second one, you still would have that happen. And so it was a money bomb for them because, wow, look at all this continuous donations coming in. Also, unfortunately, for a lot of people, a money bomb in the wrong way. So you've got a lot of seniors on fixed income who gave $500, ended up spending $8,000 unbeknownst to them until in a couple cases in the story, people got overdraft notices and that type of thing. This is from the article. Several bank representatives who fielded fraud claims directly from consumers estimated that WinRed cases at their peak represented as much as 1 to 3% of their workload. An executive for one of the nation's largest credit insurers confirmed that WinRed at its height continued for a similar percentage. So this was having impact at a national level. It was so great. And so that, again, shows you the power of this and also a little bit of the ethics. So to Stephanie, I think you kind of alluded to this before. In some ways, you're manipulating people. You're using human psychology. If it's for organ donation, most people would argue that's for good, but maybe not. If it's for raising money for a presidential candidate you care about, maybe you could say that's good. But if you're doing it in a way that's trying to be deceptive, which I think is really the point here, then that's not. So again, just ending with a great example of that. Anything else you want to add, Stephanie?
No, I think just what excites me about it is that we're in an industry where we can help people make changes for the better. And even I think about service lines like bariatric or weight loss, right? And how can you use these kinds of points to help people get healthier over time? And what can we do to use it to keep healthcare costs down? How can we use it to prevent, you know, unneeded surgeries? There's so many incredible, powerful things that even, yes, can help health systems gain more revenue, but also can help them with their overall mission to help increase communities' healthiness. So I think just that's my kind of call to action is let's all get smart and, you know, hire the right folks internally in terms of health systems and people like you were talking about earlier that can help us with both a mission standpoint as well as a business and revenue standpoint.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to call out a comment that somebody in the comments noted that a lot of what we're talking about especially from a website web design perspective is choice architecture. Completely true. And that reminds me to give one like unsolicited plug. So I already said like, this is a bit of the Bible. There's a lot of Bibles actually we've quoted today on this stuff. But this is like maybe one of the most interesting things to read about it. And Dan O'Reilly is really a foremost expert on this. He actually started a company called Irrational Labs. Both Stephanie and I have taken courses from them. You know, something you might be able to get your company to support. And it really leads you through a lot of this in ways that you can start thinking about how to apply it to what you do every day. Or in our case, what we do for clients or what you do for your own customers, including things like choice architecture. So I'd recommend checking that out if you want to go further than reading books.
Yeah. And I'm noticing earlier someone asked for the names of the books we've talked about. So we can drop them in the chat or go through those again.
You got all that right, Chase?
Yep. Yep. Awesome. That's all in there.
All right. Well, I feel winded. I suppose that's a good thing. I'm winded because also I'm still battling my bronchial irritation. I don't know if that's an official designation, but it's been hanging with me for about 18 months. You would think it'd be like a long haul COVID thing, but I've never had COVID. But I'm going to say I'm winded, not because of that, but because this has been an exhilarating conversation.
Yeah.
There's just so much we have to talk about. So Stephanie, thanks so much for joining us and bringing all your passion to this.
Yeah. Thank you.
Chase, as always, sir. Thank you.
Of course. Enjoyed the conversation.
If you would like us to talk more about this, we can certainly come back another day and go deeper. Let us know that. You can put that in the comment section. If you'd like us to talk about anything else that's important to you, put it there. You can also, if you're not with us live, always email us at nonormal@thinkrevivehealth.com with any ideas of what you'd like us to cover. My dream is to have Dan O'Reilly or one of the people we mentioned on this show. So maybe we can work for that. Have an actual behavioral scientist join us instead of us wannabes, us fanboys and fangirls. So stay tuned for that. Remember to visit thinkrevivehealth.com/no-normal for a recording of today's episode. Look for us wherever you find your podcasts, Spotify, Apple, whatever. And as always, until next week, good luck out there in the no normal. And thanks for joining us. Also, thank you for the great engagement. A lot of great comments and questions. So we always love that. Appreciate it.